This month marks 2 years since a police officer shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Inequalities in our criminal justice system have dominated headlines since then. But my next guest says the injustice goes beyond police policies and prison sentences. He says there's actually a war on the powerless in this country. Mark Lamont Hill is a distinguished professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College and author of the new book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, From Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. It's always a pleasure, Mark. Thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks for having me.
I want to first tackle this definition of nobody, because although your book focuses a lot on race, you do not keep it confined to race. You say that a nobody, when you're talking about the vulnerable, includes Black, poor, trans, queer, or other people marked as disposable. Who are the nobodies that you're referring to?
You know, it really is all of those populations and others. You know, we live in a world where certain people, or a nation more specifically, where people are rendered disposable, where certain people's lives simply aren't worth as much as others. We live in a world where certain people's misery can be erased or relocated to places where we don't have to see it. We hide their misery. We live in places where the state doesn't make them less unsafe, but rather more unsafe. These are the kind of things that make you nobody, whether you are a young Black man walking down the street in Sanford, Florida, or whether you are a trans woman in New Orleans or Minnesota, you know, trying to make it down the street, or whether you're a poor white worker in Flint, Michigan, after the auto factory shut down. We're all struggling to make it, and this designation of nobody shifts across time and space. You know, within certain contexts, some people are rendered nobody, with others are. And I want us to keep track of those things and understand that this condition of nobodiness isn't just an act of bad luck or one set of poor legislative decisions, but it's deeply rooted in American history and really in a nation that distributes resources and goods based on very troublesome criteria at times.
You make a very well-researched and documented case for the fact that the United States, the people in power, have actually been choosing who is a nobody and who is not. What is it that guides that choice? How does America, and how has America over the past, say, 100 or 150 years, chosen who will be forgotten?
You know, I think that choice is interesting, right? Because it's not, I don't think it's choice at the level of, you know, backdoor dealings or the kind of secret society, Illuminati kind of narrative that sometimes pervade popular culture. I think what it is that we live in a nation that defends class at all costs. And if you're defending class at all costs, then what happens is you have a certain population that is exploited and exploitable. Their labor gets exploited. Their jobs get outsourced more quickly. The protection that's afforded certain populations isn't afforded others. So it's not, for example, that a town or that a government said, hey, let's put lead in the water in Flint. It just so happens that when you have a nation, again, that now obsessed with certain conceptions of efficiency, what we call a kind of neoliberal ideology, what ends up happening is they find the cheapest way out. And the cheapest way out is to have an emergency manager rather than an elected official once the state becomes insolvent. The cheapest way out is to get a cheaper water resource, even though it has as many as 15,000 parts per billion of lead, when you're only supposed to have 15 parts per billion of lead. I mean, you're talking about, just astronomical levels of poison in the water. That didn't happen because people wanted to poison Black people or people wanted to poison poor people. It happened because people are indifferent to the suffering of those people. And that is what I want to capture.
It's really interesting when you're going back through decades, really. And I want to hearken to one particular part in your book when you're talking about the rebuilding of St. Louis. And this is right around the time of the suburbanization of America. And you quote this study done in 1948. And there's a line from the study in which it said there's a problem because, quote, people going and coming from work are offended by the state of decay they witness on all sides. And they're talking about some of the slums in the heart of St. Louis. But they don't mention people. They're talking about an eyesore. They're talking about these people's homes as eyesores without mentioning them as humans. And they're talking about them as a problem for the wealthier people traveling into St. Louis and out. How many examples of this did you find?
So many. You know, St. Louis, for me, became an example of this nobodiness and this idea of civic blight and sort of and seeing the conditions of the urban vulnerable as not a, a civic crisis because they're vulnerable, but a crisis because they're an eyesore to the wealthy. That kind of circumstance wasn't just St. Louis. I focused on St. Louis because it's connected to my ground in Ferguson, and the Pruitt-Igoe housing projects are all part of that kind of attempt in the 20th century to redress these issues. And it's a it ultimately becomes a failed project, a failed liberal project, as well as a failed conservative project, but largely a failed liberal project when we talk about that attempt at that particular attempt at public housing. But when I when you go around the country and we could look at the Taylor homes, we could look at Cabrini-Green in Chicago, we could go down to St. Louis, and we see very similar circumstances. Again, this isn't an isolated incident. This isn't historically unprecedented, but rather it's part of a really deep and consistent pattern that cuts across various slices of American life.
And yet you talk about something called post-intentional racism, which sounds like something a phrase that academics would use. So I hope you'll bring it back down to ground for us. Post-intentional racism, in some cases you've said you're not really worried about the intentions of some of these actions, but the consequences. What does that mean?
You know, it's a really significant point, I think, to make that, you know, everything doesn't happen at the level of intention. I think given our media cycle, given the way we have these sort of celebrated cases, we're often looking for the kind of sexy, foaming at the mouth, you know, TV-worthy incidents of racism where somebody says, I'm going to go kill a black person, or I'm going to shoot a Mexican running away, you know, or I'm going to punish all Arabs. I am going to have a special level of scrutiny against Mexican judges. For just hypothetically, and that kind of ideology is a particular sort of racism. But then there are other ways in which, despite a person's lack of racist intent, they may not have any inherent belief in the superiority of blacks over whites, at least not at the conscious level, or whites over blacks at the conscious level. But nevertheless, they're invested in a set of cultural practices, a set of psychological beliefs that allows racism to occur even when they don't mean it. Sometimes it's embedded in our economics. Sometimes it's embedded in our popular culture. I'll give you a perfect example. When if a jury sits in a jury box and watches George Zimmerman, right, and they say, you know what, George Zimmerman is not guilty because I, as a reasonable man, would have done the same thing that he did under those circumstances, right? It's not racism. It's not that George Zimmerman was some crazy executioner.
George Zimmerman was the citizen who shot and killed teenager Trayvon Martin in Florida. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Thank you. And what's interesting is, of course, in the law, we invoke the reasonable man standard, right? A jury of your peers will say, well, what would a reasonable person do under those circumstances? And the problem is, with when we think about this in the context of post-intentional racism, legally, he's free. He's not guilty. In terms of legal ethics, it's appropriate, right? Because the jury says, hey, we would have done the same thing. The problem is part of why they would have done the same thing is because deep down in their psyches, they find black bodies in public space as a form of terror. And so it's not that they think that they would have done the same thing to a white person if they had been equally terrified. The problem is oftentimes white bodies and black bodies are read differently in public space. And so even if I could say that the juror is deeply connected to some psychology of racism, I would argue that the law itself is neutral on the issue. The law is facially neutral on the issue. It doesn't say it doesn't invoke a different standard for blacks versus whites. But what it doesn't account for or allow for is the human subjectivity of white supremacy in America. It doesn't allow for the fact that the reasonable person standard might actually be a proxy for particular types of white anxiety against black bodies. And black anxiety, too, because a whole bunch of black folk might be scared of Trayvon Martin, too. The problem is there was no reason to be. He was carrying Skittles and wearing a hoodie, not a weapon. But that becomes part of the problem. So just because you pass the racist test and you say, I'm not a racist, doesn't mean that we don't have to wrestle with forms of racism in society that are deeply embedded.
My guest is Mark Lamont Hill. He's a distinguished professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College, along with a ton of other titles that you've taken on, Mark. I don't know when you sleep. His new book is called Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. And here's where we get to another really interesting part of your book, and it's where you talk about the pliability of the law. And you talk about the fact that there are not inherent crimes, that there are actions that we include as criminal actions. And explain to me how this relates to a war on the vulnerable.
Right. I mean, people don't commit crimes. There's no, I don't know, platonic realm of forms where, like, all crimes exist outside of human history, right? Well, people commit acts, and certain acts get criminalized, and they get criminalized at different times. Drinking alcohol, one moment is a crime. Other moment, it's not a crime. It's the same act. It just got criminalized at a certain point. Teaching people to read, particularly black people, was a crime at a certain point. Marrying across your race was a crime at a certain point.
Women showing their ankles used to be illegal.
Exactly, right. Same ankles, now it's just not a crime. And so what happens is, as a society, we often construct things as crimes to meet certain needs and to reflect certain values, certain morals, etc. And when it comes to the most vulnerable in our society, we not only invoke more crimes that snatch up the vulnerable, but we also enforce those crimes in a different way. So, for example, a nice middle-class person, if I were to follow them over the course of their day, they'd get in their car, and if I followed them on the highway, they probably would not always be four car lengths away from the other car. They might not always signal before they change. They might roll a stop sign or two. If I really wanted to follow them for 20 minutes on the highway, I could find something to pull them over for. You know, they may go camping with their families, and they may bring in publicly store and refrigerate certain foods, which violates in many states, public storage laws. And I could go on down the list and find lots of stuff. They may go home to their living rooms and smoke marijuana in a state where it's not decriminalized. We could go on down the list. And they likely wouldn't be ensnared in the law. There's a great book called 50 Felonies a Day, which talks about that the average person commits 50 felonies that are on the statutes right now. But when it comes to the vulnerable, we over-police. We spend all of our resources and time within those communities. And if we look long enough, we'll find reasons. That's how an Eric Garner gets stopped for selling Lucy cigarettes, or Alton Sterling gets caught with CDs in Baton Rouge, or Walter Scott gets stopped for not paying child support. And it led to these awful death sequences. But nevertheless, they were very minor offenses that don't get policed in other neighborhoods.
So, Mark, we have this tweet from a listener named Roy Lee, and he says, quote, "White supremacy hasn't stopped Asian immigrants from being highly successful in America," end quote. This seems to be saying, why have blacks not been able to find success despite white supremacy the way that Asians have? What's your response to that?
Well, I think first we have to talk about what we mean by Asian, because we often take the word Asian and cast a very wide net. If I were to look at Hmong Americans, for example, if I were to look at Cambodian Americans, their educational outcomes, their socioeconomic status is actually not unlike black people. In fact, in many states, it's worse. If you look at, for example, Milwaukee, Asian populations like the Hmong are below African Americans in literacy rates, job access, et cetera. You know, there's a great amount of work in Philadelphia on Cambodian Americans, and it's the same thing. So we don't want to cast such a wide net with Asians, because Asia is a very large place. And when we start talking about South Asians versus, we're going across the board. But for the people who are successful, I mean, there is a very large, we have to look to history. One of the things I do in my book is I situate all of the current moments within against a historical backdrop. So when you come to a country and you have the support of your nation state coming in, when you arrive in a country and the new country has economic investments for you or facilitates economic investment for you, that also creates a different set of circumstances. Asian populations didn't have to deal with the legacy of slavery here in America. My father is 88 years old, and his grandparents were slaves. So, I mean, being two generations out of slavery, you're dealing with a different set of socioeconomic barriers. Black people just got the right to vote in a very legitimate way, 51 years ago, after the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So, I mean, we're talking about a very different set of circumstance than, say, a Korean immigrant who comes over in the 1970s or the 1980s. It's just a very different set of circumstances. So I think it's apples and oranges to compare.
Yeah.
But there are also an extraordinary number of black people who have been successful. There is a black middle class. There has been a black elevated class since the 1960s. The problem is it has come at the expense of the most vulnerable of our community. And that's what I want to keep track of, the most vulnerable.
And we only have about, say, a minute and a half left. But that leads us to the question of why, no matter how many black celebrities there are, for example, that doesn't translate to a better opinion of African-Americans in general. And you say that's because for certain individuals who are successful, they get accepted into the not nobody class, right?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, some of us are seen as exceptional, right? I mean, there's the old Spike Lee movie, Do the Right Thing, where, like, this guy's a foaming at the mouth racist, but he loves Michael Jordan. He's like, well, he's Michael Jordan. He's not really black. He's Michael Jordan. Or, you know, that's Oprah, or that's whoever, right? And I think we can fall into that idea that we have these exceptional people. And in some sense, we say that they transcend their blackness. We tried to do that with President Obama, in fact. But then there's also the piece really fast that we... there's a way in which we have to keep track of that, actually. There's a way in which we have to say that irrespective of your economic position, we're still grounded by race. We're still caught up in the snares of race. It doesn't mean that we can't get out of racism. It doesn't mean that racism can't end. It doesn't mean that the world can't get better. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you can't be successful, but it does mean that there are legitimate barriers for all of us, black, white, red, yellow. We have to do that. And it's not just race, it's economic. And at the core of this book is an economic argument, not a racial argument. I'm saying that as long as we exist within a class-defending state, as long as we have a neoliberal ideology, we're going to have a world where nobodyness prevails.
Right. That is Mark Lamont Hill. It is a fascinating book, highly recommended. He's Distinguished Professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College. The book is Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. Mark, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Thank you.